we got to the core of the adversity or the trauma or the challenge. Do you understand how this is being processed in your mind, in your body, in your brain? People got to a point, so this is not my fault. This is how my brain processes when I go into a state of threat. When we remove blame and it says you've just experienced life the way that you've experienced it, and that is nobody's fault, there is a sense of responsibility as to how you want to now lead the rest of your life.
Welcome to Season 3 of the Let's Check In podcast, where we make sense of the messy, uncertain middle of modern life through candid conversations and expert insights. I'm your host, Susie McAvale. Let's check in. Have you ever caught yourself reacting in a way that surprises you and wondered, why did I do that? Or found that no matter how much you try to shift your mindset, something deeper keeps pulling you back? The truth is, lasting change doesn't begin with behavior. It begins with understanding the biology behind it. Joining me today is Maria Roberto, founder and principal consultant at Salutogenics, a Melbourne-based psychological consultancy with more than 30 years of experience in proactive mental fitness and well-being. Maria has a remarkable gift for turning complex neuroscience into relatable stories and practical tools for growth, leadership, and self-awareness. Guided by a clear, direct, and deeply human approach, her mission is to help people flourish by reconnecting with their strengths and really acting with purpose. Her signature framework, Biology Before Behavior, captures the essence of that philosophy. Stabilize physiology first, then promote behavior. In this episode, we'll explore how biology shapes our emotions, how awareness builds resilience, and how understanding both can transform the way we live, the way we lead, and how we connect. Maria, welcome to the Let's Check In podcast. It is so wonderful to have you here. What an absolute treat.
Oh, Susie, thank you so much. When you handed the invitation out, I just went, oh my goodness, I have been listening to a couple of your recordings with some other amazing people. But first of all, not only do you have a beautiful, mellow, harmonizing voice, which is so easy to listen to, but the people that you bring into your space, I think really bring some of our current issues to life, you know, around mental fitness and also just about doing life well. So I'm so, so happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh. Gosh, got me a bit teary over here. We're off to a cracking start.
It's true.
Okay, so let's start with the heart of your work, Maria, biology before behavior. You've said before that we can change what we do, but we really need to understand why it is that we do it. How does our biology influence the way that we think, the way that we feel, and how we act?
You know, that's a big question. We are in a current society where we are so focused on performative behaviors, what we do, how well we do them, but even more so recently about how we look, how we're performing in front of others. Am I saying the right thing? Do I have the right skills? And we have all of that we are thinking about. And when, especially in the area of psychology, where we are working with people who want to either improve in some way, whether they want to improve their emotional regulation, whether they want to improve behaviors in order to perform better at work or just to be a better dad, better auntie, whatever the case may be. But we also are working with people who have had really difficult experiences in adversity and challenges, and that our work with them is to try and harness them and then provide a space for developing skill sets where they are then able to move forward. And I think for a long time, our work has been around really trying to shift behavior. And people who are motivated, that works really well. There's this running joke in psychology where they talk about, you know, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is, well, the light bulb needs to want to change before, you know, anybody can make that shift. So when working with people in this space, it is always a partnership. And we know, because we have so much research to show that what really helps somebody else in their journey toward recovery is the actual relationship that occurs between both the practitioner and the client. But that's also exactly the same between leader and staff, between manager and sub-leader, between parent and child.
Between doctor and patient.
Between doctor and patient.
Mm.
And so that relationship really matters. But the first thing that we know is that when we are trying to improve quality of life, it really invites us to think about what behavioural changes. And what I've learned over the 30 years, which is so simplistic that it's a little bit embarrassing, is that nobody wants to change, even when your current behaviour may not be working for you. And that's simply because what's familiar to us is what we continue to do because it's effortless. For me, to have deep depression, which is a horrendous state to experience, requires a significant amount of change, not just in my actions, but how I think about my future, how I think about my current state, how do I think about myself. But that requires so much effort because there is so much change that's required, and that amount of effort is just on top of how bad I'm already feeling. And so people will just default back into what they know. That's not about intent. It's also about the fear of the unknown. What do I look like if I become better? How much more responsibility will I need to take? And because I don't know what that looks like, I'm less likely, you know.
And the fear of the unknown, that level of uncertainty, which is the main topic of this podcast.
That's right.
You bring up a couple of really interesting points. The effort that it takes to change. We've actually, Professor Liam Smith, who came on the podcast earlier in season two, actually spoke about this, and the energy that it takes human beings to be able to make that change is quite considerable, and often why many of us don't actually take that step towards change, even if sometimes it can be for the better.
One of the things that we also find, going back to our specialty around biology before behaviour, what we were finding was it didn't matter how much we were trying to provide the impetus for the motivation for the change. The big shift came for us when we started introducing the understanding around neuroscience and neurobiology. What I did in the last few years with my clients is that I wouldn't even be talking about behaviour change. You know, once we were able to establish the relationship and we got to the core of the adversity or the trauma or the challenge or whatever it is that they were bringing in, that we started going to, do you understand how this is being processed in your mind, in your body, in your brain? We started this journey on psychoeducation that we would present some of the information. And what happened was that people got to a point where they just go, so this is not my fault. This is how my body processes. This is how my brain processes when I go into a state of threat. Mm. So you're saying that my mind is protecting me. My brain is protecting my autonomic nervous system. So that is not just about ill will. It really is about just preservation. And so there was a shift. And when we remove blame, which is what the work around neuroscience, but in particular compassion in neuroscience, which is a new area, what that does is that it removes the blame and it says you've just experienced life the way that you've experienced it, and that is nobody's fault. But now that there is a sense of responsibility as to how you want to now lead the rest of your life, what would you like to do differently? Would you like to do something differently? Just because I think you should change, I have no jurisdiction over how you would like your life to be.
And in order for it to be a change that sticks, it needs to have that sense of agency that belongs to that person.
Absolutely.
That is a very powerful sentiment that you've really honed in on. It becomes almost objective, but with a slice of compassion around it, which often when people do become objective, I'm just thinking of different scenarios in life that you might find yourself in, whether it be the workplace or whatever. Processes and systems support us in how we live our lives.
Correct.
But when we do become objective and instigate and integrate those things, it can sometimes be void of compassion.
And that's a really big piece. That's a huge piece.
This season of the Let's Check In podcast is proudly supported by Polito Group, a Melbourne-based commercial cleaning company. What connected me with Adrian and Marty, the founders of Pluto Group, is that they don't just see cleaning as maintenance. They see it as caring for the environments that people spend their time in. And that aligns deeply with this podcast. Because the spaces that we work in affect how we feel, how we think, and how we show up each day. Pluto Group has built its reputation on relationships, consistency, and genuine care, not just for their clients, but for the people and their team as well. They're currently offering listeners the chance to win $1,000 towards a professional commercial clean for a new retail, hospitality, or commercial space. You can find out the latest competition details via a link in the show notes, or you can go directly to @PlutoGroup on Instagram and check out their link in bio. Now, let's continue the conversation.
Salutogenics has been really interested in compassion in the last couple of years, and I've been following a whole lot of research. Professor Paul Gilbert from the UK has been working in this space for over 40 years, and his story is a really interesting one. He began investigating compassion when compassion was really seen as a very ineffective area to consider in psychology. And with all of the neuroscience technology that we have today to investigate how the brain and the body responds, we now know that compassion is a core feature in how we think about ourselves, how we think about others, and how we think about optimizing ourselves. When we start talking about the biology, we have this beautiful ability to really have people honor and understand their processes rather than being afraid of them. And that really is the big game changer. And then on top of that, we put in all of the other aspects. So the big pieces for us at Salutogenics when we're talking about biology before behavior is what's something that you can do for your biology rather than you make a change because you're being asked to make a change. So it's about investing in self. It's investing in your health, in your stability, in your harmony. And so, you know, we start introducing really big pieces like understanding the core feature of optimism. There's a huge amount of research behind that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's go there. I'm so interested. What is the new research around that? What are you finding? How is it landing with people? How is it testing, if you like?
Let's just start with a definition because that sort of always allows us to land. Optimism is this future-directed mindset that's grounded in a belief that favorable outcomes are possible. That's really important. But that's the first section. It's combined then with the agency to pursue them. So it's not enough that I think in a way that allows me to optimize. I then have to match that with an action. Because if I just think about it on its own, it's just not enough. It's halfway there, but it's not enough. And it's really backed by robust evidence, linking it to things like resilience, health, and well-being. There's a really critical study that was published in 2024. They looked at going back to an alumni from a university in the States. And it was a 25-year research, so it's a longitudinal study. And we all know that longitudinal studies really hold quite significant favor around reliability and validity. What they did is that they looked at and they took baseline measures around optimism, but around well-being and all other variables. And then what they did is that they tracked them for a number of years and they tracked all of their health variables. So they tracked level of inflammation, their health, but they actually tracked longevity. So how long were these people living? And what they found was, so if you had attributional optimism, and then if you had dispositional optimism, and I'll tell you what the difference is in a moment, that both of those styles of optimism had an enormous impact on longevity. So people just lived longer and it just meant they had healthier lives. So when they unpacked the research, what was really interesting is that they looked at those people who had what we call optimism bias. And an optimism bias is where I believe everything is good all the time and I don't pay attention enough to the facts that are in front of me, which means that that type of optimism is less adaptive because it's so biased and it misses some of the important aspects of life that we need to pay attention to.
And the nuance.
And the nuance. What they found is that the dispositional optimism, this inherent belief, it's almost like a trait, that I just have a mindset that is available to me to be able to identify things in my environment that are working, that are possibilities, and that I do that with ease. What that does is that it informs the way that I problem solve. And it impacts a particular area of the brain, which is this whole prefrontal cortex area, but also the orbital frontal cortex, and also the this sort of inferior frontal gyrus area. Those areas are known to be areas where problem solving and creative thinking and complex investigation, that's where that processing sort of sits around. And people with dispositional optimism use facts very well, but they also then just marry them with this sort of favourable mindset outlook that they have. And that actually increases problem solving. It makes it more efficient, but it also makes it more dynamic. Now, the more dynamic you become with problem solving, the more that region and area of the brain actually promotes development. So you become better at being able to scan, scanning favorably, taking in the facts, knowing what needs to be addressed early. All of that really highlights and develops this area of the brain that then becomes really protective, because that's what we call resilience. So when I improve my capacity to think about my thinking, when I improve my capacity to really stop and assess and appraise my situation well enough, and I take in all of the information, but I'm not afraid of what I'm seeing that may be an issue or a threat.
And therefore perhaps take a risk.
Yes. And that those risks are much more favourable, because you're assessing the risk in line with the mindset that you have.
And in a calculated way, perhaps?
Yes, because you are appraising. That's what the attributional optimism does. You attribute what is happening much more balanced. So for people who experience depression or even anxiety, when something happens, it must be my fault. It must be because I'm not skilled enough. It must be because I don't know enough. But people who have attributional optimism, they will say, well, sure, I may have had a part to play, but I'm also really aware that Jupiter was in Mars, or I'm also aware of the moon is in a cycle and I don't have control over everything. So I tend to be a lot more lateralized with where I place my understanding of where that's come from. It's really, really interesting, because it's such a complex mindset, but it has a huge part to play in being protective of early onset depression. Research has found that the earlier we teach optimism to children, it has a huge protective factor in the development, in moderating and mediating in the development of depression, and especially with adolescents too. Which sort of links us somewhere else, in if it's okay for me to go there for a moment. A lot of what we are seeing our young people take on social media,
yes,
and the way that they are conversing with each other, there's a lot of focus on pathology. If I'm not doing this right, I must have this diagnosis. And I'm not saying that symptoms are not to be addressed or observed, and that's not what I'm saying. We are moving into a culture where there is a lot of scanning around just what's wrong all the time. And that really interferes with our ability to develop optimistic thinking.
Because it introduces a negative bias, right?
It introduces a huge negative bias, yeah. And not all optimism is good, and not all pessimism is bad, because there's a role for pessimism too.
Yeah, and it's trying to strike that balance, isn't it?
Well, it is, because pessimistic thinking really allows us to be able to fact check and fact find accurately and clearly. And sometimes, well, most times you actually need to be doing that. So it's a dose response, really. Yeah.
Gosh, fascinating stuff. So if people are not that way inclined, or genetically have some predisposition to mean that perhaps they do not have that, how can they intervene at a later stage in their development when they do figure these things out?
So practice is key. Our brain is neuroplastic, and it is about really understanding what the role that language has in shifting our perspective. So understanding the biology behind that first. So what areas of the brain are implicated in optimistic thinking, and why does that matter? Because it improves cognitive processing, but it also improves emotional regulation because there are areas of the brain that are also implicated, like the cingulate cortex and the insula, where emotion also then is brought in, that when I'm able to reason really well, that gives me a link to my emotional regulation, where I'm able to then understand that my heightened level of energy is not serving me. So let me bring that down so that my thinking can come back online. And so practice is really vital, understanding that language with optimism is key. It is really key to us being able to adopt a type of thinking pattern, a type of thought frame, that if you repeat that well enough, you know, it starts to formulate beliefs. And so the way that we think about things, how we think about why something has happened to us. If you spill a glass of milk and you say to yourself, well, I'm an idiot, that was just there, how could I not see it, how stupid of me, that is going to lend itself into the practice of pessimistic thinking, which then leads itself into a repetition. And we know that people who have high-level pessimistic thinking are 6 times more likely to experience depression. That's a really high statistic.
That's huge.
Yeah. And so really understanding, if I've spilt the milk and you just go, you know what, I knew it was there. I just for a moment, I didn't see it. My hands flicked and it's gone on the ground. Oh, I didn't like that glass anyway. Let me just mop it up. And then you start cleaning a spot and then you sort of clean the whole kitchen. And you go, oh, look, the benefit is that I've done the kitchen now and I don't need to do it tomorrow, you know.
Right.
So that there are ways of thinking about it so that it works for you. Yeah.
That's such a great example because it's so relatable. And every time it happens, right, I find myself going, oh my God, getting a bit antsy in the moment, and then going, the classic saying of don't cry over spilt milk, and then having that moment of checking myself. Yeah, it's just such a realistic and relatable experience that is so frequently tipping us over the edge sometimes.
Yeah.
Until we have the observation to pull ourselves in. I'm going to move now to your own personal story, Maria, because it's a really interesting one. Earlier when you were coming in and we were chatting, we were talking about the breadcrumbs, if you like, that have really led you to this point with connecting biology and behavior and where salutogenics now is and where it sits. Can you share with me some of your story and I suppose how that's contributed to where you are today?
Yeah. So my mother, she had huge dispositional optimism. Nothing was ever too hard. Nothing was ever too interfering that it would stop her in her tracks. And from a very young age, I watched my mother gather people. She would say, come for dinner. And both my parents had a flourishing garden. We're Italian, we're ethnic, so, you know, and we had the chickens in the back and I don't want to talk about the chickens. They sort of fared well on the table. But there was this sense of abundance, joy. And that came from the fact that they came from very difficult places. They migrated after the war where there was nothing. And then suddenly they came to a land where there was everything. And everything for them was not so much about income, but it was about how they could harness their skills around horticulture, how they could plant. And we ate just what was planted. It was that simple. But the optimism was a really interesting part because growing up, there were a lot of people in my house. And if there weren't a lot of people in my house, we would go to other people's houses where there were a lot of people there. So there was lots and lots of connection, but there was also lots of food and lots of laughter, but lots of sharing. What I learned was that the good times were always connected with other people and always stories of hope. We would go to events and we would all dress up and it was so important to share these civil spaces and celebrate milestones. But what I did realize as I was growing up was that so was wine. Wine was important. And of course, everything was homemade and it wasn't always great. You know, you would hope that they'd do a good batch. But I do remember that when they would stamp the grapes with their feet, that the children were allowed to come with their little glasses and put it under the pipe with the running juice because it was grape juice, right? Mm. Like it, you know, it was,
yeah.
And so it was sweet. And we just thought that was wonderful. But then when the wine had fermented and it was brought to the table, I remember thinking, oh, it's going to be sweet. And I tasted and it was the most awful thing because it was almost vinegar, you know. But with every gathering, there was a drinking. But before that, there was a celebration of clinking of glasses and it was salute, because salute in Italian means good health. And we would do that all the time. And I realized as I got older that that wasn't just a ritual, but it was actually a promise that we were making to each other. Salute to you is good health to you, but when it's not good health, know that I'm here to be able to support you and share that with you. And that was my experience growing up. And it was really interesting because when I became old enough and I realized that all of these elements that made up what seemed to be a good enough life, because it's never a perfect life, there are always, you know,
bumps.
That it was always around the protection of our health with each other. And then that sort of led me to be really interested and led me to move into, you know, psychology and really understand that. And then, you know, after 15 years, I then went out on my own and salutogenics then became, you know, salute and creating good health and the theory of salutogenesis, which is a preventative health approach that was published in 79. So it sort of all came together. And what it meant for me was this understanding that good health really needs to be harnessed, but it needs to be developed. And that prevention comes in the joy of sharing our understanding of our biologies when they come together.
Mm.
We have a really big focus on parenting today, being able to understand what the research is around parenting and how do we parent best. And there are beautiful programs like Tuning Into Kids and Tuning Into Teens, which are amazing because they really do support parents' understanding of emotion coaching and emotion regulation and connection and resonance in the relationship between parent and child or carer and child. There is an area that I think we're missing a little bit, and that is the importance of the language that we use with our children. Because when we communicate with our children, it's not just a direction or instruction or task. Salutogenics is really raising the value of what is purposeful conversation, but what conversation allows the child to understand what their world is about. And because we are so focused on wars and we're focused on environmental disasters, we tend to then have language that reflects all of those adversities, and we become entrenched in this language. There is a lot of attention based on how bad things are, how bad things can be, or the risks that we need to look out for. Now, if those conversations are just inherent in the way that we run our lives at home, children hear that all the time. So I think one of the things that I would really like your listeners to think about, whether they're raising children or adolescents or whether you are in the relationship that you are at home, that we are all accountable for the language that we use and the hope that we are able to immerse in those conversations. We have a responsibility to bring hope to the people that we speak to, not to believe that we can make their lives better, but to start to create this environment of connection where there is hope and that there is possibility and that we do have capacity to just be so incredible because our brains are set to do that. So just having a little bit of that focus about thinking about how we step into spaces of children and adolescents and the things that we do say. But to be honest, some of our interventions that we do in our clinic is to have very purposeful, almost scripted conversations beforehand that you move into children's spaces and not necessarily have a conversation with them, but have a conversation where they're in earshot, where that those conversations are structured in a way where optimism is really foundational.
And I'm hearing a bit of sparking of curiosity as well.
Yeah, huge curiosity. Curiosity also sits in that very same region of the brain because curiosity, creativity and problem solving are all best friends. They work really, really well together. And that then creates this beautiful lift of possibility of what next. And it ameliorates that fear, that anxiety around what do I need to be, guarding myself against.
Oh, that's fascinating stuff. I love your idea that
compassion allows us to connect first and correct later. What does that look like in practice, especially when emotions are high or relationships, feel strained?
So the University of Queensland are currently sort of taking on the throne, I guess, in a way, around the research around compassion. There's Professor James Kirby and Jamin Day and Chase Sherwood out there. And I need to name them because they are doing some fantastic research. And what's about to hit our shores in terms of how we apply it, not only is it so incredibly easy, but it's breathtaking. So they've got all of this data. What we know about compassion is my ability to be able to sense you, to be able to feel what your challenge or what your adversity is for you, my capacity to really tune into you and really understand that there is something that you're experiencing that may be causing you pain or distress or that may have derailed you, and that then I take some action to do something. So again, we are seeing this idea that it's not enough just to feel what you feel, but for me to make a difference to myself and to you, that an action is required. And that action might just be checking in with you like you do with this podcast. Tell me how you are. How are you feeling? How's it going? But not just sitting at that, really asking about what's just happened for you. I can see that your energy's shifted. Or for me to come in and be able to say, look, you know, I've noticed the last couple of days your movements have been a bit slow. I'm really concerned about you. I just want to know how you're going. Do you want a cup of tea? How about we take the coffee break and we sort of just sit and connect? And compassion is about no judgment. Compassion is about really being able to be very present with the other person with no intention of me giving you an instruction or an idea or perhaps what I think you should do next. Compassion is very much about aligning with the other person and just understanding where they're at. And, you know, for the person who is being compassionate, that means you've got to turn off everything else. You've got to turn off the fact that you want to pick up your phone that's sitting beside you. You want to turn off the fact that you need to be home at 6:30 to peel those potatoes to put on the roast. You know that you've got those 7 emails to get to that are really urgent. Compassion is about being very, very present with that other person and just inquiring in a way that is not so much gentle, but a way that is caring, so that I ask the questions that really matter. And the only way that you know that is to be able to practice that. And that's what we're starting to teach at the moment.
That makes a whole lot of sense. I'm just thinking in any kind of relationship, but it's not necessarily what we say, it's often how we say it.
Absolutely.
And how we're able to sit in that moment and really deeply listen.
Yes. So there's some beautiful research coming out by Ruth Lanius. She's Canadian. And she's starting to look at the vestibular system. So how we hear and how that whole area processes sound and balance. But tone makes a huge difference to whether somebody else is going to be activated with their cue of threat or a cue of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we are using our compassion is not just an approach of inquiry and questioning and presence, but it's also very much around our own anchoring into our own state of harmony and well-being. And there is a tone that is presented where I want you to imagine that when you're speaking, if you bring that tone down to a heart level, so you're bringing your tone down and you're talking, it's almost like you're speaking heart to heart.
Mm-hmm.
Your voice lowers, your speech slows, and there is a bit more pause, and your intonation tends to just sort of sit in this rhythmic space. When the other person picks that up, the other person's brainwaves start to then mimic that. And when that resonance is very much in this sort of contained space between you and another person, biology is synchronized. And so compassion has this beautiful transference approach. So when we are thinking about compassion, it's not some submissive, ineffective state that we go into. You know, because compassion in Italian, when you translate that, it means pity.
Mm-hmm.
But compassion is not pity.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a huge amount of strength that's required in compassion. Mm-hmm.
That's actually a really important point that you just make. And it leads me to thinking about how many people still equate strength with stoicism.
Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, how do you really think that, I guess you've spoken about this already, about the compassion side, but the vulnerability that makes us stronger, both biologically and emotionally?
So this is fantastic. I'm probably going to give you the long way around, but it's important. So when we have a look at compassion, compassion has three elements to it. The first element is strength. The second element is courage. And the third element is wisdom. So there's nothing weak about compassion. But when we're thinking about strength, strength is your ability to hold as best you can with the best knowledge in a way that promotes. So compassion requires strength, because if you're going to be compassionate to somebody, most likely you are being asked to behave in a way that goes against the dominant culture. So let's just say we're at work,
mm-hmm.
and we're in a meeting, we're in a boardroom, and we've got a manager that's probably lacks a bit of compassion, likes a task done well, is less interested in the energy of the group, and is probably very performative based. You know, let's take a stereotypical example. And somebody says, look, I think what you're asking me to do is adding onto my task list at the moment, and I probably need to finish this project before I can take this on. And that there is a response to say from this manager, where she might say, well, look, we're all loaded and this needs to be done. Now, if you think you can't do it, I'm going to give it to somebody else. And then, of course, that person goes, well, look, let me hold it, because they don't want to come across as being ineffective.
Mm.
Compassion is when someone else on that boardroom table pipes up and says, you know, I think Susie does have a lot on her plate, and I know that she's finishing that project, and I can see that giving this other piece to her means that that project that she's doing is going to have less attention. Is there some way that I can help with this? Now, so first of all, you need to identify strength in being able to say that. But then secondly, the courage that comes with standing up against the odds.
Mm.
Because to be able to be compassionate means you've got to step outside of yourself. And then the last one is wisdom. And wisdom is really interesting, Susie, because with compassion comes knowledge. I really have to think deeply about what's happening for you, for me, what's happening around us, all the dynamics that create this space. And it's only the wisest person that can make the best decision about when to say, when not to say, how do I? And being wise enough to know that whatever is happening at the moment, that to put voice to that is actually much more important than the status quo. So when we're thinking about the idea of strength that you put forward, you know, that this idea of being stoic is so far from what our biology talks about, that our strength comes from feeling deeply, not from avoiding or dismissing those emotions, because those emotions provide us with information about what needs to be happening. And so to be wise enough to listen to that and then respond with heart is huge. And compassionate leadership just has a very big part to play, not only in harnessing well-being wherever we are, the workplace, family, or but also in being able to promote our best selves.
It makes us feel better, doesn't it? When we sit in that place and we operate from that place, it really changes things from feeling uptight, not feeling great about ourselves, to a release, like you were saying before, about kind of trusting the process.
Yes, and trusting that when I take that risk, that it may not fall the way that I would like, but I've made a stance. I've actually allowed my values to stand true. And that is what then allows us to be able to continue to go back and go, well, what else can I do? It just really holds us anchored. Yeah.
And also stressing that courage and demonstrating that courage and what that would do also for the relationship. So in that scenario, if you had done that, we had done that around a table and you really went into bat for me, all of a sudden there's a bond that's created, and then that dynamic is strengthened as well. which has a huge effect on culture.
Huge effect, because suddenly I trust you.
Mm.
And trust is something that can often be underestimated. But when there is trust, it means I pool my resources. It means I share more with you than I would normally share with other people. I'm less protective of myself, so you get the best of me. And that trust allows us to then work together, because we're working in a common way for a common outcome, but with very, very similar values. It also builds further courage and further leadership.
That's some great things to think about. This is a fantastic conversation. Thank you, Maria. My final question is a question that I love asking our guests, and it's something that we ask every single one who sits here with me. And that is, what are you feeling uncertain about at the moment, and how are you best supporting yourself?
So we've recently launched Salutogenics, and we've launched some new products where compassion is at the centre. So we've launched some new products for the corporate market around providing conversations of care that have been created with a very specific protocol that aligns with brain activation. It's really exciting. And they are preventative conversations of growth and optimization. And what I'm feeling uncertain about is how well that's going to go and how much interest is there in our current world for us to place a little bit more emphasis on prevention. You know, we're very good at wanting to grapple at interventions during crisis time so that we can stop the hurt. But I'm sort of feeling uncertain as to where that's at. How I manage that is I go back to my values, and I go back to me being compassionate about my 30 odd years that I've spent. And I go, I'm so certain that we are so much on the right track, and that what I'm doing is reaching out and bringing people along the journey and finding those people that align with us. So that sort of balances the uncertainty a little bit. And then to be able to say, just having these conversations to share the message of prevention and also health. Yeah. Mm.
I personally have been the recipient of someone in your workshops in a workplace, and I can hand on heart say that they are absolutely sensational. I don't remember if you remember the day that you came to our place, but
absolutely.
I was so glued to you at the front.
No, I think you were the one taking all of the notes.
Yeah,
there
all
was,
of the notes.
There was someone else on the table as well, you know, and I looked over and I thought, they're going to run out of pages.
Yeah, that's literally what happened, yes. But
you're a very good student.
I don't know what to say to that, but thank you. Yeah, sparking that curiosity is absolutely key, and that's something that you bring so many environments that you step into, which I'm very grateful for. Maria, thank you for helping us see that when we really understand our biology, we empower our behaviour, and ultimately we help each other to flourish. To learn more about Maria's work, visit salutogenics.com.au, where you'll find resources on mental fitness, the Soma and the Soma Circuit programs, and the latest in neurobiology-led workshops and compassionate leadership training. Maria, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here on the Let's Check In podcast. Well, thank you so much.
Susie, it's been an absolute delight. And to have this space with you, I'm so fortunate. Thank you very much for asking me to be here.
Very welcome. We're all taking in a lot of content. And sometimes the most useful thing isn't more, it's hearing something twice. Before we wrap up here, this is what stayed with me in this conversation with Maria. So often when we want to change something about ourselves, we go straight to the behaviour. What should I do differently? What this conversation really reminds us of is that change usually starts much earlier than that. It starts with understanding what your body and your brain are already doing to protect you. A lot of the reactions that we judge ourselves for, shutting down, getting overwhelmed, avoiding things, they're not flaws, they're signals. And when we meet those signals with a bit more compassion rather than pressure, something tends to shift. So maybe instead of asking, what's wrong with me, try asking, what do I need right now? Thanks for checking in with me today. If you haven't already, hit follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if this conversation resonated, share it with someone you'd like to check in on. You'll find guest details, resources, and the link to the Let's Check In newsletter in the show notes. You can also follow along on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Let's Check In Podcast. Before you go, though, a gentle reminder. This podcast is not a licensed mental health service, and it is not a substitute for professional advice. If something has come up for you in this episode and this season, please reach out for support. In Australia, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.